This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Do I see any hands coming up there? Right, yes, sir, in the middle.
Thank you. Jeff Holden from City and Guilds. One of the key, if possibly not the key, drivers of school behaviour is, of course, the accountability measures that they're subject to are made public. One of the strong conclusions from the Wolf Report was that having a single accountability measure doesn't work and it just drives poor behaviour. So I'd be very interested in the panel's views on what ranges of different accountability measures will actually help us move towards a much better system.
Indeed, if you had tracks, would you not need several different kinds? And would they be equivalent? Anybody else? Anybody else like to pick up that point or one of the points we've had before? In front.
Ron McClone, Cambridge Assessment, retired, and also OCR. I'd really like to say that we've had a long debate with a lot of different views, and drawing it all together is going to be mighty difficult. I'm very impressed and hopeful that OCR's contribution is going to go in the right direction. Is 14 the new 16? Yo. It is and it isn't. It is in the sense that practicality is already taking it that way, as Mark has already said. That is where young people are seeing themselves being different. 16 was only arbitrary, may I remind everybody, in the first place. As was 15. 15 went to 16. 16, of course, is going to 18. Where was 14? The one thing I do worry about, and I don't know whether anybody has any solution to this, is when will 14 become the arbitrary number that we wished we hadn't got?
Okay. I'm a little confused on the research here. We've had a couple of points on this. I think it was Ken that said that research indicates that students are placed on a track almost from birth. And Graham has mentioned that students at 14 probably know what they're going to do. I wonder whether the research says students know what they're going to do or they've arrived at this point at which they are more or less constrained about what they're going to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do at the age of 24, so I'm not quite sure if I know any 14-year-olds who have even the faintest idea of what sector they'd like to be in. So I'm just a little concerned. Has anybody got any information on in that sort of field that could help us, sir?
Jeff Hayward, University of Leeds. 3 points. First, please stop using the language of ability when you actually mean social disadvantage. Because other countries achieve much, much higher rates of academic attainment than we do, and I don't believe their populations are genetically any different to ours. We have a fundamental problem of expectation of our young people. Second, the progenitors of school failure start at birth. The best person probably to intervene is the midwife. Leaving it till 14 to remedy educational failure is way too late. The Millennium Cohort study already shows there's a significant gap at age 2 between young people from disadvantaged backgrounds and those from more advantaged backgrounds. So that's where my comments about the pathways are set at birth. And then thirdly, you've got to get real about the labour market. You've got to understand that you can pump out qualified young people from our education system into our labour market, and it will not make one iota of difference to how the labour market works. You will still have enormous numbers of young people. Just read the TUC report that came out yesterday. You'll have enormous numbers of young people, who are employed in low-paid jobs, because employers can get away with paying low wages.
Does anybody else like to pick that up? Or any of the other points we've had before? I'm just looking at the data, the, sorry, the, it's a little bit of democracy at work here. So the outside, online, we now have over 1,000 people watching online, incidentally. They have not run with how you have in the audience here today. In terms of the questions we asked, externally set exams at 16 are the most reliable method of validating a student is ready to go on to study subjects, was a resounding disagree externally and a resounding agree internally. So people watching online don't agree with that. Interesting, though, that online, age 14, is a better starting point for students to take courses leading in different directions. A stunning 99% of people online either agree or strongly agree. So clearly, there are a large number of people out there, and that will be a mixture, I suspect, of educationalists who can't make it today and other people that are interested in this. However, where it starts getting very different again is if a national examination was to be introduced at age 14, what would its primary purpose be? You'll recall that 40% of you said no exam, and then the others were split relatively equally between progress checks, subject knowledge, and selection for routes. Externally, 67% think there should be no exam at 14, and if there is to be one, the remainder of them think it should be a progress check. On the upside, an education system that allows students to opt for different routes, 63% of you thought it could work, and 20% of you thought it probably wouldn't. Externally, 75% of them think it could work, so they obviously have more faith in our ability to put together a system. And only 25% said probably not. So that's a little bit more information that we've got there. Would anybody like to take us in a slightly different direction or to tackle something we've already done? Tim?
Yeah, can I go back a bit? Right, to return to your question about the seeming contradictions in the research, that a lot of work has been done with young people, talking to them directly, and also looking at destinations in terms of the labour market and looking at transnational comparisons. Now, it seems as if the research points in different directions, but it doesn't. By 14, identity formation in young people is very strong. They do have an idea about who they are and where they want to go. Doesn't mean they're right in that. Okay, but they have a strong notion of it. The best systems capitalise on that by actually linking that identity formation into motivation and get them on programmes that they think are going to give them good things. And by dint of good design in those systems do. They still have a very strong diet of high-quality mathematics, focused on literacy, science, Hillary, but contextualised. It's presented in a form which they think will be necessary for them, so they learn it. And the OECD says, if you take freedom away from people and have them on education programmes, for which the state is spending a great deal of money, it's a good idea having them learning as much as possible during that time. So that's very prudent. That's what happens in the Netherlands, and I referred to it in my presentation. Now, so you can now see there's not a contradiction. Okay. Now, to go back to the other point that one of the speakers made about general skills, if we look at Germany, okay, people make choices, they go into the vocational route, they choose one of about 360 occupations, which looks unbelievably narrow from the outside. But because they're on long-duration training, strong psychological contract with the employer, immersion in work, learning all sorts of skills of employability and socialisation into the labour force and into the workplace, good behaviours, as it were, a large proportion of them, typically in the past it's been about 40%, immediately gain employment at a high level in an occupation other than the one for which they've been trained. So they're on a specific route at a very early age, 16. Okay, it looks incredibly narrow. It looks dysfunctional because they've made a choice to train in an area for which there may not be jobs in the economy at the time at which they graduate. But because of the quality of the learning and its duration, they are immensely flexible. They can then capitalise on the genuine opportunities which are there in the labour market when they graduate. Now, that's the kind of sophistication and thinking in terms of systems that we actually need to formulate good policy, to get beyond the illusions the realities of deep structures which provide high quality learning and genuine flexibility.
And then if I ask the audience then, if we then look at what Monsieur Gauthier said in his paper, points out that systems are grown historically and built almost accidentally, and that it is often a bad move to try and either imply there's a system or give it a system. In what sense can we look at Germany? Can we look at Holland? I think Hillary's probably got something to say at this point. And look at these places. Holland is very, very small, very homogenous. Germany is very large, yes, equivalent, but it's built on a whole different system, almost reconstructed in 45 to 50. On radically different lines than came before. To what extent can we look at these people? And we've just talked about bloody Finland, as it were. Should we all be going to Holland? What can we actually draw even from societies that are in the same cultural... So I'm not even going to think about what we could draw from the Far East. What can we draw from these societies that is actually going to make any sense whatsoever in the particular cultural and historical growth of... private schools, still got bits of grammar schools. Then we've got UTCs in a quite heterogeneous system. Hillary, would you like to? You've looked into this for a very long time.
Yes.
What can we pull?
Thank you.
Can we pull anything?
I think we can pull out a very important lesson from looking at other countries, not just European countries, which we might claim have a very different tradition and cultural culture from our own, but by looking also at English-speaking countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and we can see that human potential is much, much better developed and promoted. The potential of their young people is being developed to a much higher level than we are managing to do with our young people. And there is absolutely no reason why we should not find a way of achieving the same level, or perhaps even a better level, than those countries have achieved. And I think that is the thought that needs to motivate everything we do. As soon as you start thinking about, well, what do we do about UTCs, what do we do about grammar schools, the mind cannot cope anymore. But if you hold on to the fact that we just must find a way of getting the best out of all our young people, and that means aiming to do what other countries do, to have them in education or in apprenticeship or in education with workplace experience, probably until the age of 18 or even 19, and getting to a level where they are really competent in mathematics, in their own language, and where they have a really useful level of occupational skill. That should be our aim. And everything we learn about other countries shows us that it is possible. And we have known this for 20 years or more, but somehow we have lacked the will to achieve it. And I could, as I see it, I think the will is there now. I think the necessity of achieving it is there, and the will is there, and I think we can do it.
But somebody like Graham, I'm going to put words in your mouth, somebody like Graham will then turn around and say, fine and good. Possibly the problem in the past is we've picked the wrong bits, and we've gone overseas, we've looked at this country and that country, we said that seems to be the bit that works, we've incorporated it into the UK, and it hasn't delivered that broad vision.
Yes,
so Graham is going to say to you, which, okay, he's going to New Zealand, or Canada, as it may be, which bits should he be looking at in Canada that would work here, that he should be looking at with particular emphasis?
The one place we shouldn't look at is the place we always go to.
Finland.
No, the United States. Every innovation in our education system over the last 10 years has come from the United States. Beacon schools, academies, all these things, we look at a country which has a dreadful record of developing its young people. And we ignore, or we have ignored, very largely the countries of Europe, which are so close to us. And I think we have begun to take note of what is happening in Australia and New Zealand. But yes, they are countries which have tracked systems from age 16 onwards. They have a lot of high-quality vocational colleges and vocational education. Australia has twice as many apprentices as we do, taking into account their population. There's a great deal we can learn, but we must have the will to put it into practice, take difficult decisions, offend interest groups, forget about stakeholders, just do what's right for our young people.
There you are, Graham. How to lose an election very quickly.
Is it worth coming back on that? I mean, yes, the government, because your remarks just now further compounded the general trend that my speech formed part of, suggesting that everything is bad in what we're doing. And I think there's an awful lot of good in what we're doing, and we mustn't. A great danger of doing yourself down is to ignore the strength of much of our system. But there is recognition in government, and that was true of the last government, but also this one, on apprenticeships. And John Hayes is bringing poetry to the prose of apprenticeships, and is absolutely dedicated to promoting that. And I think we will see many more apprentices. If I may, Bennett, just come back from Jeff's initial point. I'm absolutely right. We need a system of assessment and accountability that gives equal weight to the progress of every young person. And I'm pushing to try and get, I think, Andy Burnham, and to get the both sides on the House, because I think that is acceptable to everybody. We need an assessment and accountability that gives equal weight to the progress of every child or young person. It's much more difficult to do, but it does mean that you can raise questions about the English baccalaureate as one more distorting measure, if that becomes the be-all and end-all. What you do need is much more information, and the government, I think, has taken on board, I think, has slightly recoiled from some of the responses to the early steps, and is looking at publishing much more information. And I hope people in this room can form part of providing that series of performance measures. It's just like the select committee once said, it's like in business. If you make sales the be-all and end-all, you tell everyone in the company it's all about sales because your sales are a bit low, it will lead to loss of margin, loss of quality, loss of focus. You have to have a mixed score, and we need to have that across our system and that's the danger of one great measure distorting the rest of the system. We must minimise the distortions within the system. As to what that looks like, I know that's much more difficult, but I think we need much more information and try to, and not only get the assessment right, but understand the reality of the accountability systems. What really drives a head or head of department in the real world in an institution? Not my theory of it, either an assumption that they're automatically a good person or my suspicious assumption that I need to check up on them all the time. Treat them as a professional, but don't be naive as to the drivers that will affect their behaviour. We've already seen that with the baccalaureate. I've had a head in front of the committee saying that they do, he said, and this is just one of many examples, I wouldn't want to stigmatise him, but he said they do an excellent half GCSE, which I didn't even know existed, so that's my ignorance, in history and geography. And they had a proven record of people going on to do A-levels in history and geography and doing really well. They were scoring zero, of course, because they don't count towards the English back. So they dismantled that, even though it was a proven system within the school. So there are so many perverse outcomes if you don't analyse that. When will 14 be found to be arbitrary? I think that's very interesting. But at least it would appear, far more so than 16, which was entirely arbitrary, that there is collected evidence. There are academics looking at it who suggest that 14 is a sort of sensible age, although it'll never be perfect. On the point about the early intervention, I think that's absolutely right. And there is, again, on a positive front, there is cross-party agreement about that. And you said the midwife should be involved. I think some people would say it should be pre-birth, so parenting classes prior to birth, so I don't think birth's the point of it. And there are bringing the health number of health visitors is being increased. The health visitor role is seen as crucial by the new government, and the numbers of health visitors was reduced, so it stopped being a universal service, and the aim is absolutely to bring back so it can be a universal health visitor service, often working around sure start centres as well as GPs, so that there is early assessment of children to signpost them to support. So I think that's a fair point. And I'm delighted that, unfortunately, you have to be as clever as Tim to be able to work out that all the research points in the same direction. Perhaps I'll get him to do a one-to-one seminar with me and straighten me out when I'm struck by all the confusion and contradictions.
Thank you, Graham. Chris?
Just 4 quick points, really. First of all, I think 14 is... It might be arbitrary, but having been my background as a biologist and knowing a bit about human biology and hormone levels, I think 14 actually, if you've taught in the secondary sector, actually isn't an arbitrary figure. I actually think the hormones starting to stabilise and life starts to move on. So that's really quite an important. Generally, I believe it's a very important aspect. Secondly, just a plug for vocational education as not being. Siloing people into a particular career. Best example in FE, an absolute best example, is hairdressing and beauty therapy. We produce zillions of them, absolutely zillions of them. And at one time I thought, why are we doing this? This is not sensible, when I was younger in the system. They have the best employment record of almost all the FE world coming out. And they don't all become hairdressing and beauty therapists, but they become top managers in retail. They become, because it's a 3-4 year program, is hairdressing and beauty therapy. And they learn customer skills, they learn reception skills, they learn the finances of running a salon, they learn health and safety of the products and all the rest of it. They have skills. They do have genuine skills, which the retail sector especially want. And so they all do very well. So that's that bit. The bit about the question somebody raised about what are we going to do about the foundation learning type students, the ones that need to get to level 1 by 19 or level 2 by 19. I actually think we do need to take a refreshing view of that and actually say outcomes are probably more important than qualifications. Mm. Going back to my nephew, Tim, who's got Asperger's, him getting a job at 21 in the classic car industry, valeting cars, getting ready for customers after they come off the shop floor, for him to actually stabilise his Asperger's and get interested in something he needed to do is probably more important than getting a piece of paper. If he gets a piece of paper later on, that's fine. But, so it's outcomes, especially for the lower, the lower paper ability students. Because he's actually very gifted in lots of ways, but exams and writing is not what he's going to do. And then the last point, the plug for European practice, the AOC and... RAD, the equivalent of AOC in Holland, are doing a 12-month European project on best practice for re-engaging the socially excluded and the students in danger of being socially excluded up to 16 to 24s. And we'll probably be knocking on Graham's door in 12 months' time saying, this is what we found, what does the government want to do about it?
Can I just come back on the point about social disadvantage? I think even in Germany, that there's 20% of students that go to the general education, the general vocational educational school, and in Germany that's not high status, and it's the bottom, it's the rump, if you like, of the system, but they do still make an effort to make it the best it can possibly be and provide good support for those students. And the other thing to say is it's 20%, not 40%. So I agree, there's a long way to go, but you will always have some kind of bottom tier of the system, and you need to do the best you can for that. So I don't think raising aspirations is going to solve that problem. I would say that also that we have to start from where we are, and it's very hard to make those changes in aspirations because a lot of them do come from parental influences and so on. Very hard for policy to affect that. It's deeply ingrained in culture and so on. It can be affected. It's a very slow game, and you need a sort of incremental approach, and you need consensus, and you need to stick at it for generations to properly change it. So I think we don't need to think in terms of, many, many more kids going into the sort of EBAC route rather than doing perhaps a core of academic subjects in another route. I think we do need the other routes because we have to start from where we are, unfortunately. And if we just start with this sort of utopianism, which ends up as a kind of a depressing negativism because we'll never achieve from where we are the kind of everyone doing an EBAC, then I think that's highly destructive because it leads to a kind of, pessimism rather than optimism.